Namaste and welcome to the Pure Flow Yoga Live Class and Conversation Podcast, a place where we get to go deep, connect, and open our bodies, hearts, and mind together to spread love, inspiration, and good vibes. We're living in truly extraordinary times. The world is changing in a unique, profound, and unprecedented way. The best approach to staying centered, balanced, grounded, strong, and at ease in these times of transition is to prepare ourselves spiritually, physically, and emotionally. I believe yoga, meditation, and music are helping to awaken, unify, and harmonize people all around the world. So I really hope you enjoy these classes. If you want to stay connected, sign up for our love letter at pureflow.yoga to stay totally current on all of our upcoming blog and podcast releases, as well as our online and in-person events around the world. And if you love what we're doing, please consider supporting us with a small donation at pureflow.yoga/podcast. Your journey to being more inspired, embodied, and connected begins now. Welcome to the podcast. My guest today is Tanya Capps, founder of One Yoga School and athomewithtanya.com. Tanya is a transpersonal psychology coach and resident yoga teacher at Bali's legendary Yoga Barn. She's also a mother and has been studying the spiritual system of yoga and teaching internationally for 2 decades. Tanya's burning curiosity of the big questions, why people suffer, what's really true, why some people are happy and others aren't, has led her on a deep journey from the outward approach of higher education, where she studied and graduated with a degree in integrated science, to the more inward approach of yoga, which she describes as the science of the interior. Tanya has been sitting with her teacher, Swami Vagishananda, for the past decade, focusing on traditional pathways for spiritual growth and awakening. And she's been initiated into teaching Vedanta, the wisdom teachings of non-duality and oneness. AtHomeWithTanya.com is Tanya's regularly updated online offerings, which have over 250 hours of classes, training materials, detailed posture library with alignment, puja, chants, meditation, pranayama, and satsang, talks to unfold yoga's main spiritual texts. Tanya, I'm so excited to welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what are you passionate about sharing these days? What is your offering in the world?
I'm passionate about sharing yoga in its broadest sense as a system to support people in spiritual growth and spiritual awakening.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. So what has been your journey? You started from a more academic approach, mm-hmm. and now you're here 20 years of teaching later.
Yeah. Oh, well, the outside expression of how I would explore and my journey overall has been wide and varied. Really, fundamentally, the underlying question has been the same, and it's really it's the spiritual questions, it's those perennial questions that I think really lie at the heart of every human being, and that's how can we be free, how can we stop suffering, how can we find happiness independent of conditions. And I just remember when I was very young, this started very young, I would look around and I'd see the adults and some of them seemed very unhappy. And of course the story was, go out, make a lot of money and succeed in the world and then you'll be happy. But I could see that there were adults out there, you know, grown ups that had tons of money but were miserable. And then there were people who had very little money that were very happy. So this paradigm didn't seem to answer my questions very reliably. And so that was just the burning question, is like, why are some people happy seemingly? And then why are other people in such suffering? And so I wanted really to get to the heart of that. And so, yeah, I studied science and looked at more external explanations like psychology, biochemistry, and so on, and then social explanations and the social sciences and so on. And the degree that I took was an integrated science, so it looked at how everything was connected also, which was very satisfying to me. But then later, really, I knew that very clearly after doing just a few yoga classes that this journey was going to take me inward. And so inward I went, and here we are many years later. And I'm passionate about sharing this system of yoga. We have to do the work on ourselves, but it has given us this precious map. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. This ancient, thousands of years old system that gives us these incredible tools to help us deepen in self-awareness and deepen in self-acceptance, which is really where this journey takes us. And that's really happiness. If we're in complete self-acceptance, then yeah, it leads to universal acceptance. And then that's really, that's where this journey takes us. So yeah, it's the happiness question that has driven this whole journey.
Beautiful. Yeah. So before you were here in Bali, you were in Hong Kong at Pure Yoga, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. What was that like?
That was an interesting period. I came there in my late 20s, early 30s. And that was a time where yoga was just beginning in Hong Kong. It had started the beginning stages of growth. There were some studios there, smaller, but then Pure Yoga came in, and now they are a mega studio internationally. You know, but I came at that time of this massive growth and passion, and it was like the yoga frenzy days. It was quite for me, it was a step away from the life I'd, a big step away. I'm more of a small, sort of a country girl.
A fellow Canadian.
Grew up with a lot of nature around. It's a really grounded kind of slower lifestyle. And then landed in the heart of Hong Kong, where it's very busy and buzzy, and people are going fast there, generally speaking. So it was a time of a lot of growth there for me. As a teacher, I was teaching insane amount of classes and also practicing. So I was in the studio 6 to 8 hours a day, whether I was teaching or practicing. And I was obsessed with my asana practice at that time, doing one or two classes a day, sometimes four classes a day on this, when I had those days, the time to do it. Yeah, so that was a time of intense growth, and passion and busyness, and yeah.
And I wonder if you can speak to this a little bit. I was very similar when I began my practice of yoga, very hungry and obsessive with the asana practice because of the way it made me feel. Mm-hmm. And then for me, as I've journeyed through the years with the practice, the focus for me has gotten a lot more subtle and turned a lot more to more meditation and slowing down. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you've had a similar journey, because I know when I come to your classes, they're super intelligent and creative in the flows, but I feel like when I come to your classes, what I'm really interested in is hearing the philosophy that you weave.
That pathway is actually, we could say, is a universal pathway. And in the Vedic system, which is the lineage that I come from, the Vedic tradition of yoga is a pathway for realization. They describe the pathway of the yogi from gross to subtle. First, we start in the external world, where we, if we're interested in spirituality and we're interested in these questions of, you know, as I mentioned before, how can I be free? What's happiness? Who am I really? What's really true? If these existential questions are arising, then traditionally that person would start in the external world. They'd start doing something like karma yoga. And so they're noticing their behaviors, and they're noticing what they're eating. They're noticing, am I being harmful to other people? What are my ethics? They start noticing those kinds of things. But then the attention starts going inward, grosser level, like the body. And so the asana practice becomes very strong or prevalent in one's sadhana practice at that time.
What is sadhana?
Sadhana is practice, yeah. Uh-huh. So there'll be a large emphasis in physical practice for a period, but that naturally there's this, you know, the intelligence of the system is that it takes you inward, and then you start noticing subtler things, and then energetic practices such as pranayama can start coming in, or just bringing in breathing practice into the asana is a natural step for any practitioner. Then going subtler still into mind, meditation, contemplation, self-inquiry. These are considered the latter stages. And in the Vedic system, they describe the earlier, younger years. And now people are picking it up at different times. And so, you know, we don't live in, you know, thousands of years ago. We were living in modern times. But we can say the trajectory is somewhat mm-hmm. the same. But in the Vedic, they say, okay, for the first period of your life, lots of asana, 75% asana. In your mid-years, 50% asana, more meditation. And in your later years in life, 25% gentle asana, reducing, and then primarily contemplation, self-inquiry, and then some meditation also. So you're moving in that direction ultimately.
Wow, I didn't realize that it was an actual codified trajectory. That's incredible.
Well, we could sum up the spiritual journeys going from the gross to the subtle.
Right. Yeah. So what does your practice look like these days?
Well, for the last 10 years, I've been sitting with the teacher, Swami Vigishananda, and the Saraswati lineage. His teacher was Swami Dayananda, and really moving into Vedantic teachings, which is the unfolding of the sacred texts of, it's called Tattvamasi, which is basically unfolding. You and I are one, or you and the universe. I and the universe are one. It's all one. So it's oneness teachings. And in this tradition, it's said that all of these practices that we do are leading us to recognize that all is one. And so I sit in contemplation of that a lot. And the sacred texts, the Vedantic texts, just unfold that teaching. It's purely direct teachings. Who am I? What's really true? You know, how can I stop suffering? They're very directly asking these questions. And how am I? And this thing that appears so dualistic, this world that appears so dualistically, how is that true that I am one with everything? So that's we could say it's the subtle practice of it's listening to the teachings, but also contemplating and inquiring.
So would you consider, you know, within the four traditional paths of yoga, there's karma yoga, bhakti yoga,
classical yoga and jnana yoga, yeah.
Yeah, and so you would consider yourself more a jnana yogi.
A jnana yogi. And in the Vedic system, as you described it, it comes in that order, actually. You okay. start with the bhakti karma yoga practices, which are more the behavioral, social disciplines and receiving life's moments with every moment, any given moment, receiving the moment with glad acceptance. And then acting without attachment, selfless service. That's the karma yoga. And then that practice actually has a way of really emotionally and psychologically maturing people. So there's less reactivity, less frequency of reactivity, less intensity of reactivity. And life is just generally more, things don't ruffle your feathers as much. So that's the karma yoga. And so we're working with the grosser elements, as I mentioned, of day-to-day life, you know, interactions with people and what we're eating and where we're going, and we're starting to really live more consciously. That's the first stage. And then that calms somebody enough, basically, speaking really just sort of simply, is calms you down enough that when you actually sit down, you're not a volcano inside. And so then and suddenly this classical yoga, the eight limbs, the meditative path, sometimes it's loosely called, to be able to sit and meditate is actually accessible because you're not boiling up inside and the mind's not running to 100 places at one time. You can actually sit and then see what is. And really meditation is just a being with what is. And then you start, because you're starting to see what is, you start to open up to what is really true and why am I suffering? And suddenly there's an opening from within to these deeper truths. And then that tends to wake up a whole lot of passion and interest in these questions also. The spiritual desire gets very, very cultivated, nourished, stoked through meditation. It has a way of doing that. There's this interesting alchemy that meditation offers. Not only does it give us peace and well-being and all of that, but it actually tends to really stoke the spirit, the inner fire, spiritual yearning. And at that time, it said, then Gyan Yoga is just, you're thirsty for it. You just want to sit and listen to spiritual teachings because it's just, that's where your spirit's calling you in that direction. You just listen and just, it's like the best, most nourishing time to just sit in those teachings that are really validating everything that you are. You're sitting there saying you're full and complete. You're already whole. Mm. You're already holy. There's nothing to fix or change. And every other being is divine. And that feels good.
Yeah.
But there's a part of you that you just, your heart knows it to be true. There's a knowingness when you hear that that's experienced. So it doesn't feel like you're taking this on conceptually. There's a sort of a deep resonance because it's your nature that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a deep resonance there and a knowingness, and so it feels like in Gyan Yoga, this is why there are those stages they talk about when there's that, they call it readiness. You're calm, you're passionate, you're interested, then when you hear it, you're just like, of course. You right. hear it and you're like, I actually already know this. And you just bathe in those teachings, and that has a way of integrating just by soaking it up. It's like a sponge.
It's such an interesting thing because there's such a focus in today's culture and today's world, in this growing business and world of yoga, such a focus on asana and the postures and the physical side of it. Mm-hmm. And really, that's just a preparation to create the conditions for what you're speaking about.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So how do you approach that?
I'm in a unique situation at the Yoga Barn. It's very transient and very busy. So it's not uncommon for us to get 60, 80 people in a room.
Amazing.
And that room is filled with a wide variety of people with different intentions and different we could say levels of awareness,
mm-hmm.
And depth of practice and so on. So I like to teach in a way, and this is actually how I teach my training teachers when people are coming to my trainings.
Is this the one yoga school?
Like the 200-hour training. Uh-huh. As a general scaffolding or skeleton on which I hang my teachings, I'll always start the practice with more physical emphasis. So that's naturally, as I mentioned, the journey overall of the yogi is gross to subtle, meaning from right. physical to energetic to the subtle mind and beyond. So naturally, within a pose and within a practice, awareness will move that way. That's the natural movement of awareness from right. if we have a sustained focus. So at the beginning of class, people are coming in, their awareness has typically been very outward, and they're busy, and who knows what conditions are unfolding in their life. So the very first thing I do when I come in is try to create a coherent space, shift people's attention into their body, which is a big leap from being out of the head and into the body. And we just start moving the body around, and that helps people become present and grounded. And then I'll start shifting the emphasis to breath, because breath itself is intelligence. So if breath is moving, it starts to take over. Mm. And so if, as a teacher, I can skillfully guide someone to really anchor in that breath, the thinking really starts to go, and they move into a meditative state, at which time what defines a meditative state is it's like hyper aware. The aperture of awareness becomes very refined. It's like going from a 5x zoom to a 10x zoom to a 100x zoom. So breath is an awareness expanding tool. So if we can get to the breath and lock that in, then people start moving into those deeper states. And then when there's a readiness, after a certain period of moving and breathing, then you drop in the teachings about mind or spirit, and then there's an easy seeing. If I were to talk about it at the beginning, there's just too much
chatter.
The best analogy is there's a calming process. So like if you think of the waves on an ocean, if the waves are really busy and you try to look into the ocean, you just see the waves. And so when the mind's really busy, you're just in the mind, the story of the mind, and you actually don't see beyond that. It's like a veil that's covering the moment, the story on top of the moment. But if we can be skillful, like just moving your body helps to shift that chatter. Breathing shifts it even more. And it's like the waves calm. And suddenly you look in the water and whew, you notice everything underneath very easily and clearly. It's more like a reveal rather than this active seeking. You just calm and still, and then that's what's there. You see it very easily. It's not like you're creating something new. You're just creating conditions to see more clearly. And so that's what yoga does. It's, we're not creating anything new. The beginner is just as divine as the someone who's more deeply seeing. They're absolutely equally divine, but someone who's been inquiring, calm and interested enough to look, they just see. There's a seeing more clearly.
Beautiful. I love that metaphor. I fully visualize the waves and, you know, definitely have moments in my life of calm and definitely have moments in my life of, you know, that story veiling the truth. So
this is one of the great gifts of yoga in general is the yogi becomes aware of their state of consciousness and they become aware of the effects of their state of consciousness. And so, you know, as you were saying, it's totally human to go have days that their things are more turbulent and some days we're more calm. That's totally human nature, totally natural. And it's our divine human nature. But the yogi becomes aware of how different states come and go and how these affect our decisions and behavior and so on. And then we also, through that heightened awareness of self and states, we've also simultaneously refined our capacity to respond. So if we notice we're all like wound up, we also have the tools to calm ourselves down. It might take a moment. We might be identified and be in that reaction or that tension or that busyness. But what tends to happen through long-term practice is you go, okay, I'm wound up. I know how to calm down. We can do it just by taking a few breaths, or maybe you take a dedicated practice for, you know, where you're actually on your mat and doing a formal practice. But that's a beautiful gift of the practices. Life's totally not tossing you around. You can stay in your center and ride those waves of different states of consciousness and respond.
Yeah.
And learn to respond.
It's that reactivity versus response thing.
Exactly.
Because the waves are going to keep coming.
Yes, that never changes.
That never changes.
Yeah. This is a big, I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is one of the biggest myths, we can say, of yoga, that I hope that any practitioner gets this myth dispelled as soon as possible. Yoga is not about creating a perfect state. It's cultivating the capacity to be with all states and respond. Without attachment, but
oh, totally. Yeah. And I'm so grateful for that reminder all of the time, because even if I've been studying and practicing yoga for so long, and as a yoga teacher, I feel like people project onto me that I should already have achieved enlightenment or freedom, and maybe they're surprised that I'm still suffering and that I'm teaching what it is that I need to learn.
There's idea that yogis never get sick, or yogis never have emotions, or yogis, it's like, independent of any state, independent of any what we might call a stage, which is just a label, but independent of any physical, mental, emotional state, can we be free in and through? That's really, it's like the reed in the wind, you know. I think there's a Zen metaphor of the being the reed in the wind.
When you're talking about this state and stages, this reminds me of some Ken Wilber.
Yeah, Ken Wilber. Big fan.
And you're a big fan. Can you tell us about the states and the stages and what the difference between those two are?
Sure. State of consciousness is changeable in any moment. Yeah. So this moment, my state, I might be calm, and the next moment I might be more emotional. So there's that kind of state. There's also the states of waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, and then there's the non-dual. States of consciousness, you can't be in two states at one time.
Okay.
You're either in one state or another state. If I'm happy, I'm not sad. If I'm sad, I'm not happy. If I'm sleeping, I'm not awake, and so on, right? And states are constantly changing. Stages in Wilber's model. Now, it's been a while since I've been in Wilber's, been years, so I won't be referencing his terminology or exact definitions exactly, but just as a general term, he talks about growth stages, that people's consciousness moves towards more expansive, inclusive stages. So when I'm a baby, there's just me and mine. Yeah. And then as I grow, there's a we. It could be my family, and that might extend to my country. But then as we grow and we open, we become in the stages model more and more, ever more inclusive of what I would call me. So first it's just me and my body as a baby. But then as I grow and inquire and have life experiences and the life conditions offer me these opportunities to grow, I can move to higher stages, which are defined as greater inclusivity, greater care, sense of justice for all. It's a sort of more of a technical definition. In yoga, if we're talking about the stages of yoga, also this integration, this greater and greater inclusivity is the same feature of what defines different stages of growth. I like to move a little bit more these days away from stages, because it can really very easily, even if I try to explain and dispel myths, it can very easily pull people into it. Not there yet, not there yet, not there yet. Right? We're always exactly where we need to be.
Thank you for unpacking that a little bit.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. Everything of Ken Wilber's I've read has just been really fascinating. And I know that you've spent the last bit of time studying transpersonal psychology and moving into becoming a transpersonal psychology coach. And I'm really fascinated about that. Can you explain a little bit about what that means and, and how that helps people?
The reason I wanted to study transpersonal psychology coaching is the particular style of coaching they use, whereby if I am meeting with a client, an individual, and they have some presenting life issue, I am not giving them specific tools, some kind of cookie cutter approach for their ego to then latch onto. Okay, if I work really hard, a white grip, you know, what's it called? The white knuckle grip. It's like, if I work really hard and try starting Monday, I'm going to make sure I do this, you know, achieve this goal that I have.
It's which is a much more traditional coaching.
Traditional
method.
Coaching approach. And I don't want to
also
take away that there's, you know, a lot of incredible coaching models out there. What I love about this is it transcends the ego. So in a coaching session with the client, we would move into a very open state, like a meditative state, a very, very open state. And then we allow what's meant to come through with the little guidance from me. And as a teacher, similar to the yogic model, and actually all the wisdom tradition models, we would take a journey from gross to subtle, and we would unpack deeper and deeper layers. But I'm not, as a coach, coming to you with some preconceived strategy. There's a reveal, which is the same principle of yoga. Yoga is a reveal of what's already there. So, but we don't see, we're veiled. Uh-huh. Yeah, and we can get stuck in tunnel vision and pattern thinking and obsessive thinking. And so if we can open and loosen the grips of that, then the deeper reveal is now more accessible, which is again the same principle as yoga. So the reason it was valuable to me to become a transpersonal psychology coach is I wanted to support people one-on-one more. That really is the bottom line. I'm as a teacher teaching very large groups, it's always, we could say, top-down teaching, general teachings, teaching in terms of universal truths. What can I teach that everybody can hear? But at the end of the day, we're individual and we have unique challenges and we're at unique places of inquiry, and I want to be able to support people with specifically where they're at.
That's wonderful. I'm so happy that you're doing that. And what is transpersonal psychology exactly? Like how is it similar or different to yoga? I mean, obviously this reveal aspect is central.
Transpersonal is like beyond the individual separate self.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what that means. So we're going, I'm just going to have a little glass of water here. I have a
go
tickly
for it.
Throat.
Go for it.
Yeah, it's, we're in that place where we're going beyond the mind. Going beyond the mind. And also holding space for any contents of mind to be there. So it's kind of like looking at yourself in a way, as a metaphor, we could say, from a bird's eye view. And so we're looking, and that allows us to gain more perspective, allows us to take like a broader perspective, but also take on different perspectives. And again, that loosens up the grip of the ego, which can tend to really lock down and have very strong habits, habitual thinking. And if we're identified with those habits of thinking, that really is what defines suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's being identified with those thought patterns. So if we can get a little thumb space, oh, I see those thoughts, I'm not my thoughts, let me look at it from a different angle. And what might, if let's say we were coming with a relational issue, I might be able to sort of zoom out, and then be able to take on, oh, what might the other person's perspective be, you know, and just as an example. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it. I think if I were ever to go back and do, you know, higher education in psychology, it would be this transpersonal mm-hmm. approach. I did a bachelor's degree in psychology, and it was so science-based, and it was very focused on abnormal psychology, mm-hmm. all of the things that could go wrong, right. rather than, you know, right. what's more present in today's field, which is more this positive psychology, this mm-hmm. more transpersonal psychology, which mm-hmm. feels mm-hmm. to me to be a lot more empowering and individual. And
yeah, and very loosely speaking, it's really it's now where psychology is marrying with spirituality.
Love it.
Right? Because psychology in the past, more behavioral and cognitive and so on, is confining the inquiry into the individual, whereas transpersonal is now going into the connection of the individual with everything. Mm. It's validating that space of one with the whole. And so for me, the cognitive psychology coaching, it's interesting. I just wrote a paper on the relationship, how the system of yoga, in terms of the paradigm, the underlying mechanisms they use for healing, growth, transformation, they're the very same ones that the transpersonal psychology is using.
Is there anywhere where we could even read that article?
I have not posted it yet. I still have to get graded on it.
Okay, this is part of your degree or your program. That's excellent.
Yeah, this is an amazing program. It's through the Aleph Trust, if anyone out there is ever interested in that. They have a whole bunch of programs on spirituality, consciousness, through an academic lens. So there's a rigorousness and a groundedness, so which I appreciate. I appreciate that side of it as well.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing. Mm-hmm. Last week, I was at a 5-year-old's birthday party, and I got to hang out with your daughter a little bit, and that yeah. was so great. I asked her if she was a unicorn or a mermaid, and she's like, no, I'm a kitty with wings.
Very clear about that.
She's very clear.
Yeah.
How has life changed as a yogi since becoming a mother?
It is the greatest spiritual practice. It may sound cliche to say, but it is absolutely true. And so many people say, you know, the greatest spiritual practice is being in relationship, the intimate relationships. And I have the great honor to be in an intimate relationship with my daughter. We spend so much time together, and it has been my greatest yoga, really. It has been challenging when you know, those first years where there's just utter exhaustion and physical exhaustion and aspects of my psyche that I didn't know existed coming to the fore, like fear for her, you know, just worrying about my child, you know, and then sort of navigating these places that I didn't even know existed before I had a child. And so it's brought up a lot of deeper unconscious material, which I think there's one woman, I wish I could remember who it was. I remember what she said, but she said spirituality is basically walking through your shadows. It's a journey of facing your shadows. I wish I could remember who it was.
Love it.
Yeah, so we're meeting our unconscious material, all these places that we're identified. And then trying to, we can say, simultaneously become deeply present to them, but also deeply accepting of them. And that's the path of integration, rather than I'm only looking at the light. It's, you know, equally looking at the uncomfortable places within ourselves. And so relationships have a great way of exposing our shadow.
I think probably all of our listeners can relate mm-hmm, to that.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is why, as we, you know, we talked about earlier in this podcast, it's not about being some perfect, crystallized human being. All of this, these practices bring up they bring up that uncomfortable stuff. And so the deeper you go in your path, the more uncomfortable material is now ready, ripe for the processing. And so if you're feeling crazy and rage and anger, you can say, okay, this is great. This is grist for the mill of deeper awakening. And there's nothing wrong with any emotion or any mental thought form. We just come back to the practice, be present, validate my human experience, because it's always going to be that mix. Yeah. And so, motherhood has had a way of bringing up things that I might have not been able to see in a more renunciate lifestyle that I was living prior to having a child.
One of my teachers and mentors, Dr. Bobby, she just says, like, awakening is not beautiful.
No.
And it's not comfortable. No. And if you truly want that freedom from suffering, which is essentially the kind of quote goal of yoga, let's say, it's having that willingness to go into the shadows. And I know when I think, you know, I'm at that stage of life, a lot of my friends are having children, and I'm kind of have to really get clear on, is it something I want to do? Is it something I don't want to do? And I do notice that there is a lot of a fear of having to grieve the person that I am now, and all the busyness and all the projects and all the connections and the travel, all that I've loved to do. So thank you for being such an inspiration of how motherhood is just such a beautiful spiritual practice.
And in no way did I feel that I was leaving my spiritual path behind in having a child at all. I actually said, okay, buckle up, now your real sadhana begins.
So you spoke of, you know, the decade or so that you've been with Swamiji. Mm-hmm. Are there any other people that have been pivotal on your journey, other inspirations or books, people, anything that's been really transformational or inspiring to you? Mm. I'm sure many things.
Nothing has come even close, I would say, to that level of profound inspiration that I've received from my teacher and I continue to receive. A great teacher they're very precious jewels and rare to find. I've had many inspirations along the way. Human beings, period, inspire me. I get great inspiration I live in Ubud, and there are, you know, every now and then I'll just sit on my patio, and I'm a big fan of lounge chairs of all sorts. I sort of collect sitting chairs so I can be comfortable when I sit and contemplate. So I have hammocks and big round egg chairs with 1,000 pillows and so on. So sometimes I'm sitting in those chairs and I just reflect on my community here and the people in my extended community are all doing very different things, passion projects. They're healers, they're teachers, they're conscious entrepreneurs. And this community of people gives me a lot of hope and inspiration that just as human beings, being in full expression, but also that there's a lot of hope for our planet.
Yeah. You know,
there's people living in a different kind of a way. That inspires me.
Walking the walk.
Walking the walk. When I walk through my day, it's big enough that it doesn't feel like we're on top of each other, but small enough that when I go out with my daughter in the day and I have my few errands to do, I have to give myself an extra hour or so, because you know, for the run-ins and then the conversations you have. And
I love that you schedule that in.
I do, yeah. You never know. And then just talking to people, they just inspire me constantly. And I look around at all of these people doing wonderfully inspiring and contributing, really being of service to the world. Mm. Very selfless and inspired people. And it's not an easy path. And I see that there's a lot of bravery and courage for people walking this path as well. So so the people in my life inspire me. My community inspires me.
Yeah.
and nature. Sometimes I think if I just had no obligations, as it were, I would just, you know, plop myself down in the middle of the nature and never come out. I say that in sort of a joking, but I love nature. For me, it has a way of, because we are nature. And so when you sit in nature, there's just instant recalibration and remembrance. It's just so easy to access deeper wisdom and remembrance. And so...
You're so not alone in that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I move through the day, and here it's also very beautiful. Nature's around us. Flowers and butterflies and birds. I also have a daughter who absolutely adores nature, as many kids do. And so just walking through the day and being inspired by where my eyes land. So that's big... Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. So many inspirations all around. And I don't know if you'll be able to answer this question or not, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, they say having a teacher on this path, that guru-student relationship, is so important for our development. But how do you find a teacher? Like I said, it might be a hard question to ask.
I think we all have the right teacher at the right time. And it was not surprising to me that I found my teacher at the exact time that I was ready for those teachings. Yeah.
So this is that when the student is ready, the teacher appears thing?
Yes, yes. Prior to meeting my teacher, I had that. It wasn't so much like an event as like some peak experience, but I was driving around on my scooter, and it was just a moment where I just, you know, as they say, you throw your head back and laugh and you see the great cosmic joke. I just sort of, not sort of, I just saw very clearly without all cognition. It was just, oh, I could see that I was not who I thought I was. I could see that I was this ever-present witness that's always been there, always has been, from my 2-year-old self to my 5-year-old to my 20-year-old to my seeking yogi to my... Suddenly, I could just see that. It was just a seeingness or knowingness, and I still had my same body and my same quirks and my same humanness. None of that changed. There was just recognition, I could say. So it wasn't like a sudden change of state in that way. It's just sort of a seeing. And what followed was a period of just, it did affect me after. It did affect me. I was sort of in this state of absolute peace and joy and nothing left to do. And I just sort of sat on a chair. We have a mutual friend I was living with. And she said, yeah, I just sat in that chair. It was just this sort of, oh, I'm done. I wasn't done, but I felt like I was done at that time. But it was just that recognition of non-dual being. And then I met Swamiji. And then he's like, he just sort of said, okay, well, it's not a state and it's not a... And he started really unfolding it for me. And so then I've been sitting with him for about 10 years. So,
wow,
which really unfolds that in depth. But, you know, I don't know if I would have met him prior to that moment. It just sort of...
Yeah, you were ripe.
There was a ripeness, yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Super fascinating and interesting. I had a little look at Home with Tanya. It looks incredible. Mm. Well done, and congratulations on that. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is that you're offering online?
I am creating a platform largely inspired by my very international transient student base.
Right.
I want to be able to support them. They can't always fly to Bali to come in and study and practice with me. And I want to be able to support them. So how can they keep up a regular practice? That's one thing. And how can they get the teachings and the growth pathways? So I said, well, I guess the only thing to do is to offer online, and we can do that now. It's very accessible. So the idea is to create my approach is to support people to keep up a regular practice, because regular practice is one of the foundation principles about how we deepen our self-awareness and so on, and heal and transform and grow. Regular practice. Step on the mat every day, or step on the cushion, sit on the cushion every day. So having guided practices for people that they can go to every day. Second, a section that people can dive in and actually learn and train, which is different than stepping on and doing your daily practice. First, you have to learn the techniques, learn the principles, and if you do this step, then the next step is this, and once you learn this step, then the next step is that. That's really valuable, the learning stage. So learning, there's a learning section, and I've got a, pardon me, I have a tickle in my throat today. I recorded the 200-hour teacher training, the morning practice, and the lectures. And so if someone wants to learn the principles of Hatha Yoga, day one, we learn a principle. Day two, we learn a different principle that builds on that first day's principle.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so when you're doing public classes, you get a little bit of everything, and there's, you know, it's not broken down. And but, you know, if you go to a guitar teacher, if you know, the first thing they say, okay, put your fingers here and do that for a week. And then the next week, okay, this is a new note. You know, you put your fingers here and now do that for a week.
Mm.
That's just a natural way we learn. We don't get it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So that section is do this first. Let that integrate. Do this next. Let that integrate. And it honors the natural pathway of gross to subtle. So the first classes are more in the physical realm. And there's also posture clinics. So if people really want to break down each individual posture, like 5 to 10 minutes on each pose, they can go in and break down. This is what my toe is doing. This is what my ear is doing. And, and so on. And can really break that down. But then they can build. By the latter, when we're getting into the later in the training, you're working with breath. Later on, you're working with mind, and finally more into the spiritual and non-dual teachings. So that's a natural trajectory. So someone could do that practice. It's a 2.5-hour practice. This includes meditation, pranayama, and so on. Do the practice, you know, once a week, and then for the next week when they're doing their regular daily practice, or next month, however long they feel is best for them, they can really integrate that principle to give them a growth pathway. And then the third section is getting more into contemplation, self-inquiry, meditation, the subtle practices. It's different than Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga, you're moving your body and so on. The actual sitting, contemplating. And so my teachers asked me to start teaching Vedanta, which are the non-dual teachings. So I'm now going to be offering those online, just little bit by little bit, satsangs, where we actually ask those questions that they're the questions that really are driving everyone's life. We all have a strategy. How can I be happy? We have answers to those, just largely unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
How can I be happy? And how can I stop suffering? And then our behaviors and actions all play out based on those beliefs. So the Gyan Yoga or Vedanta or non-dual teachings goes right to those questions.
Mm.
How can you be happy?
Yeah.
And then you really take a very close look at the way you're living and asking, is that actually ultimately going to give me happiness, you know? And so then that's the final section. It's more the spiritual teachings of yoga. That's the final section.
I love it. It's a super accessible and affordable way to go deep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to make it very accessible. Yeah.
Great. So one last question, and that is flow. So flow is central to my world. My main project is pure flow yoga. And I just wonder, what does that word flow or pure flow mean to you?
Mm. Flow is our nature. I just think we are flow. We might have moments in our mind where we think we're not in flow, where we're resisting what's happening and we're fighting. But actually our very nature is flow. And when we are just resting with what is, that's very evident. It's very evident. And so what a grace to be able to offer what you're offering to bring people back to that remembrance and point their awareness, their attention back to that essential nature that we are flow. There's no finite, static I. It's never existed. It's never been. So
yeah,
beautiful. I love that word. I love it.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for taking the time to sit with me today and to help inspire and uplift all of our listeners out there.
It's my pleasure, my joy.
Thank you. How can we find you?
I have, at this time, I have two websites. So I have TanyaCaps.com. So it's that website outlines all of the offerings that I have, like teacher trainings and so on. And then At Home with Tanya is another website, and that is all the online practices and classes and teachings and so on. So if you want to find out when the trainings are and information, bios and all of that informational stuff, TanyaCaps.com. But if you want to practice and learn, that's the other one, At Home with Tanya.
You're one of my favorite teachers, and I love to keep practicing with you. Thank you so much again. Love you.
Thank you. Love you.
Thank you so much for listening and tuning into our podcast today. I really hope that you got a lot from it and feel really inspired and uplifted. Please help us help you by spreading the love. Tell a friend, leave us a 5-star review, and make sure to sign up to our love letter at pureflow.yoga to stay connected with the community and receive our free weekly love and inspirations, as well as be the first to know about our upcoming blog and podcast episodes. We're also going to share with you special deals on our Thailand yoga retreats that we just don't share anywhere else. And if you want to help support these efforts, which it takes a lot of time and love and energy to spread the love in this way, and we want to keep doing this for you, so please consider sharing a monthly donation, a contribution, and you can find that at pureflow.yoga/podcast. So hope you have a really beautiful day, a really beautiful week. Feel free to reach out anytime, and sending you so much love. Yeah.